Okay, I'm going to bring the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 22nd, and the time is 3:31. And with us today is Senator Giesel, Senator Coghill, Senator Wilson, Senator Egan, and of course myself, Chairman Meyer, and Christine Marsigan is here, my staff, to help committee members. And we also have Chris Dickrow again with us, the recording secretary. And we have a new LIO moderator, Eileen Keim.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Every once in a while I get the names right. Okay, so today's agenda is confirmation hearings. We'll continue with that. We have the Lieutenant Governor successor, Valerie Davison, who is here. And then we'll take up the Board of Fish appointment, Orville Huntington. And after that, then go into bills, Senate Bill 186 and House Bill 31. Okay, so with that, Commissioner Davison, if you would join us, please. And I think we all know you, but for the record, if you could introduce yourself and just tell us why you want to be the Lieutenant Governor successor.
Hoyana, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Davidson, and I currently serve as the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. And it really was my honor to be nominated by Governor Walker to be Lieutenant Governor's successor as outlined in the Constitution as well as Alaska statute. I should just say for folks who are in the department or folks who are watching at home, I had a lot of calls when this communication was relayed across the Senate and House floor that I'm not planning to go anywhere. The Lieutenant Governor isn't planning to go anywhere. But a statutory requirement is that we have a third person named as successor just in the event that something happens so that Alaska is prepared should something happen to the governor or the Lieutenant Governor. So those folks watching at home, I have no intent to go anywhere. The Lieutenant Governor isn't going anywhere, but we always hope for the best and plan for the worst. Tell you a little bit about myself. I was born and raised in Bethel and also grew up in Aniak, upriver, very small Yupik community. We consider Bethel to be like the New York City of the region, because it has about 6,000 people. When I was growing up in Aniak, we had about 400 people in our community. When I was 12, my dad's job changed, and as a result, we moved to Salcha because my dad took a job as a civilian employee at Eielson Air Force Base, and so spent my junior high and high school years at Eielson Air Force Base. For college, for undergrad, my undergrad is actually in education. I started off as a teacher, a bachelor's in elementary education with a specialty in early childhood and a minor in bilingual education. I started at UAF, University of Alaska Fairbanks, and then had the opportunity to do a legislative internship through the University of Alaska system here, and I did an internship for then-Senator John Binkley, who was co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. I then got hired on staff, and I worked full-time for him during the day, and I went to school full-time at night. And I was on a little bit of a long-term plan for finishing college, but I finished in 1992 and taught for a little bit here in Juneau, and then before I went to graduate school. My career has really, I worked for a year in Bethel when I was done with graduate school, and I worked for a year in Anchorage, for my for-profit regional corporation, Jalista Corporation. And then I moved back home to Bethel to work for the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. I was there for, I think, 7, maybe almost 8 years. And then I moved to the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, where I worked for about 9 years, almost a little under 9 years. Before taking the position as Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. So, in a nutshell, I take service to community and service to our state very seriously. And it has been, I would say, when folks come to work at the Department of Health and Social Services, I promise them excitement, and boy, do we deliver. And when folks ask what they really should expect from me, I say, well, the nature of this work is healthcare is going through a lot of change, and so we really are miracle workers on an expedited time frame. And no matter how quickly we move, healthcare, I think, is changing so much. Our state is so dynamic that sometimes it never feels fast enough, but we certainly do the best we can with the resources that we have. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate your thoughtful consideration.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner Davidson. How do you pronounce your middle name again?
Nukhagalok. It's my Yupik name, one of my Yupik names.
Okay, great. Well, I'm not going to repeat it. Okay. I'll take your word for that. Okay, so I think we have some questions for you. Just going through your resume here, though, you're well-educated, and that's great. You've done a good job as commissioner over probably our largest department from a budget standpoint anyway, or one of the largest. Maybe education's more. I see, though, that you've spent some time on the fetal alcohol spectrum disorders program. That's an area of interest of mine, and just seems like we should put more focus to that, because that's one disability that's 100% preventable with if we could just get people to avoid alcohol during the 9 months. What more? And again, you're I keep wanting to question you as the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, but you already have that job. So, but if you wouldn't mind, just tell me what we're doing in that area to for prevention.
Sure, Guyana, Mr. Chair. So my involvement with FASD issues really began when I worked in the office of Senator John Binkley for the Senate Finance Committee, because at the time there really was very little public education about the dangers of drinking while pregnant. And Senator Binkley, I think it was actually when originally passed legislation was perhaps on the House side, but we had to do a little bit of cleanup work on the Senate side, because there was a requirement for businesses that were serving alcohol had to post a sign, and the sign had to be a certain size. Well, unfortunately, at the time, we discovered the unfortunate challenge of loopholes, because folks made the big giant signs but printed it in really, really tiny letters, so it wasn't very clear. And so there was some cleanup work that happened to ensure that we had to specify that the letters had to be a certain size so that we could help to educate folks about the dangers of drinking while pregnant. My work at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, where I worked for 7-8 years, we certainly saw the effects of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Folks used to believe that there you either had fetal alcohol syndrome or you didn't. There was one or the other. But since that time, we've learned there's actually a spectrum. And someone may look like they're not affected at all, but they may not have the facial features. They may not have, you may not be able to recognize that, but they're still suffering from the intellectual challenges. And they may look like an adult, but they certainly aren't behaving like an adult in terms of intellectual capability. So when I worked at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation, we worked with a number of independent, small, nonprofit organizations that had really grown, grassroots organizations that had started simply because when the Indian Health Service was there providing health care on behalf of the federal government, they really weren't providing that level of service. And so a lot of these grassroots organizations came forward to provide that service because the Indian Health Service wasn't providing that. as those services were transitioned from the federal government to a tribally operated system, the tribal health organization, YKHC at the time, worked with those nonprofit organizations to be able to allow the state to be able to take advantage of 100% federal match for Medicaid services. And those services in the region were primarily almost 99, maybe 98% provided through Medicaid funds. And so by having YKHC integrate those services into its own delivery plan, and many of those employees were hired on, just did the same work but worked for a different company, were able to allow the state to be able to save 50% general fund match. I think in terms of our work as a state, we've sort of ebbed and flowed in terms of our attention to fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. I think one of the challenges we face is that every time there's a new drug, whether it's that has prevalence, whether it's opioids, whether it's spice, or whether it's something else, we also need to recognize that alcohol, unfortunately, in our state remains our number one killer and the number one issue that we are confronted with as a state. I think really the issue that we all need to get to is, why are folks in Alaska self-medicating? Why is it that folks are wanting to use drugs, including alcohol? And a lot of that really has to do, we know now, with adverse childhood experiences. And what is it that that's happening in childhood that that causes folks to want to self-medicate? And so I think the more we can do that work on the front end, I think we're going to have much better outcomes further down the line.
Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioner. And again, I'm sorry to ask you a medical question because you're here as the appointment to the Lieutenant Governor's successor. Okay. Other questions? Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Davidson, the current governor and his lieutenant governor are both independents. Can you, for the record, let us know your affiliation?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Meyer, Senator Wilson. I'm sorry. Let me try again. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, my party affiliation is nonpartisan, like a number of folks in Alaska, and it has been for many years. And I chose that that registration because I wanted to be able to have the flexibility to choose which ballot that I've been able to choose in elections. There are some years where I've chosen a Republican ballot, and there are some years that I've chosen a Democratic ballot.
Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Outside of the normal roles, statutorial and constitutional roles, Lieutenant Governor, what do you see this position as?
So, through the chair, Senator Wilson, besides the regular statutory roles, which are, I think, pretty significant, and I'll get to the other part of your question in a minute, but just for the folks who are at home who may not, I have had some folks say, you know, I'm not really sure what the lieutenant governor actually does. So the lieutenant governor, I think one of the biggest responsibilities is the lieutenant governor supervises the director of the Division of Elections to ensure that every Alaskan has the opportunity to have their ballot, to be able to vote in an election and to have their ballot count and to ensure fair and impartial elections. They also help with when our districts are up, that next apportionment starts in, I think, is in 2020. And so when the districts are either changed or adjusted to be able to deal with population changes, the Division of Elections provides information to ensure that that process continues as well. Many folks also are familiar with the regulations, and those are published by or under the Alaska Administrative Code that are published by the Lieutenant Governor. The Lieutenant Governor also oversees the use of the Alaska State Seal. There are restrictions on when it can be used. It can only be used for official business. When foreign governments seek to authenticate a signature of an Alaska official, the Lieutenant Governor provides that authentication for foreign governments when it's required. The Lieutenant Governor's also commissions the Alaska Notaries Public to ensure that when folks sign official documents, legal documents often, that they certify that that person is who they say they are. The Lieutenant Governor's office also publishes or maintains the online public notice system as required by statute. One of the things the Lieutenant Governor's office is not required to do by statute but has for many years is also publish the Alaska Constitution. In other cases, the Lieutenant Governor also serves, really stands in on behalf of the governor. You can imagine, as you all know, the position of governor, lots of demands for his time or her time in our other in the past. And so the Lieutenant Governor also steps in to be able to represent the office of the governor when the governor is not able to be there.
Senator Wilson?
I guess, as clarifying, just to know if you envision this role to be greater, do you have greater, Lord forbid, something happens to our Lieutenant Governor, do you see that role as redefining that role if you were the Lieutenant Governor? How would you redefine that role if you were in that position?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I think, I don't know that I would necessarily I mean, it's hard to say that right now, whether I would redefine that role. I'm not sure that I would, just given the fact that we are about to go into an election cycle, and that is a really, really heavy lift for the Lieutenant Governor's office as well as for the Division of Elections. I know that in the last election cycle, almost 3,000 employees were hired to be able to, as temporary employees, to be able to handle ensuring that we have fair and impartial elections. So I don't really see a substantial change if I were to assume this role. I will say that I will be honest that my when the governor and lieutenant governor first asked me about this, I told them that I was absolutely honored, and of course would happily step in to assume that role should something happen, but that they should know that I very much enjoy working with them. And that my family every day prays for their good health. And once this nomination was made, we've kind of doubled down on our efforts just because, you know, we always wish for the best for everyone that we work with.
Anything else, Senator Wilson?
I'll pause on that slide.
Is there questions from any other members? I might just say that with having a background in as a lawyer, that one of the duties, I've looked into a little bit what a lieutenant governor does. One of the duties is to approve initiatives. And I know you would work very closely with the Department of Law on whether or not an initiative is legal or not legal. But sometimes it seems like you have two lawyers and you can get two different answers. So I guess that's where your background in law would be beneficial. Do you see that an area of concern? Because it seems like we are getting more initiatives these days.
Mr. Chair, so the Lieutenant Governor oversees not only initiatives but also referendums and recalls. And you're correct that the Lieutenant Governor and the Division of Elections do rely upon the Department of Law to be able to provide that legal analysis. And I just want to be clear to you and to the rest of the committee that I am not stepping into, an attorney general-like role in this position. I very much respect the office of the attorney general. Likewise, in this position that I'm currently in as commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, We have had conversations about a variety of things over this term about what policy direction I would like us to go in litigation. But I also respect that the Attorney General makes that decision on behalf of the state. And to your first point, that sometimes if you have two lawyers, you'll have two opinions. Sometimes if you have three lawyers, you'll have three opinions, et cetera, et cetera. And that's just the nature of the work. I think that reasonable people can and do disagree.
Very good. Senator Wilson?
Yeah, another question.
No more questions? Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Let's see. We'll go to public testimony then, if we have any. I think most of these are probably for the other conferee. So there's no, so I'm going to close public testimony on Commissioner Davidson. And if there's no other comments from the committee, thank you, Commissioner Davidson. And if there's no objections, then I will read the verbiage here. In accordance with AS 3905080, the Senate State Affairs Committee reviewed the appointee and recommends the appointment be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. And, of course, this does not reflect an intent by any member to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. So thank you very much for joining us today, Commissioner. And then, Christine, if you want to go ahead and pass around the signature page, and we'll go we'll just keep going here, and we'll go to the next conferee, which is the Board of Fish. Let's see. And that's Orville Huntington, and I believe Orville is calling in. Orville, are you online?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair, I'm online.
Okay, very good. If you could put your name and affiliation on the record and why you want to be back on the Board of Fish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Orville Huntington. I was originally from Hoosier, but I live here in Fairbanks, supporting my children's college education. I work as a wildlife and parks director here at Tennessee Chiefs Conference. I've served two terms so far, 6 years. I'm mostly just a subsistence fisherman, but I rely on a lot of personal use fish from my family members. I used to have a Y-4 commercial fishing permit, and because of my age and my health, if I do get on, this will be my last term. I've done my service to the state of Alaska, and it's been an honor. This would be the last time I'm coming for you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, very good. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Are there any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Huntington, for your service to the state and serving on the board. In your opinion, since being a previous board member, which do you feel is more important in terms of serving on the board, the user type or the geographical location?
I think it's probably a combination of both. We get a lot more information from those local fishermen in that area where we were meeting, but the problem is they're always conflicted out. So what balances is it does seem to be the user type of who they represent when they come on the board. But I find that all the board members I've ever worked with have been fairly unbiased. We're all open-minded, and we try our best to represent everyone from the state of Alaska because these laws are so important. I hope that helps, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Does that help, Senator Wilson?
Yes, thank you, sir.
Okay, I do have a question, Mr. Huntington. Again, I thank you, too, for your service on the Board of Fish. It's a tough committee, no doubt about it. And it's my understanding you're kind of the tiebreaker, because I believe there's balance, we try to have a balance on the board of sports and commercial, and then I believe you're the subsistence representative. And, of course, I live in Anchorage, and I have both personal use, sports, commercial. We have a little bit of everything in Anchorage. And I know at one of the meetings, and I'll lose track here, it was voted to have your next meeting in Anchorage, and then somehow it got changed, and now it's down on the Kenai Peninsula. And I was just wondering, how did that happen? I try to follow the meetings, but I missed something there somewhere, because I thought the meeting was going to be in Anchorage, and now it's on the Kenai. So can you let me know what happened there?
I'm not sure exactly, but it seems like every time we change over board members, we end up voting again on a former board action. And I think because one of the board members is stepping down, they wanted to correct whatever mistake they thought they made. I'm always open to changing it. I've come from a rural area. I lived most of my life in Galena, where I fished fly for years, a commercial fisherman. I really wish that we could meet there, but it just financially it's about impossible. You guys do such a good job down in Juneau, but still our state resources are so tapped. And I think that it would be fair to those fishermen down there. At least I felt that on my last vote, to give them a chance locally to provide us with an opportunity to hear the voices. I did hear it when we met down there, right? I think it was October work session. And down in Kenai, they treated us really well, and I thought it was fair that if I couldn't have one in Green, I'd at least like to have some out in the area where the people fish. But I really respect the people of Anchorage, and one of my favorite places. It was hard for me to vote no on Anchorage, but we'll see what happens with a new board member. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, yeah, very good. So you did change your vote then. You were a yes, and then you were no to Anchorage, is that correct?
Yes, I did. At the time, I didn't have a preference either way, and the board membership at that time favored Anchorage, and I have no idea what the board membership will favor in October, but I'm always open-minded, and I'd like to hear the discussion.
Very good. Senator Diesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Huntington, thank you for your service on the Board of Fish, and I also was pleased to hear that the Board of Fish would be meeting on the Kenai in the near future. So my question has to do with a piece of legislation that is promoting an interesting idea, that being that board members are often conflicted out. That is to say, maybe the vote or the subject is on commercial fishing in a certain area, and a board member has a permit in that area. And so they have to actually leave the table and go sit in the audience. I think this particularly happens on the Board of Game, but apparently the Board of Fish may have this same issue. And so the proposal by one of the House members was that this be modified so that the board member who had a permit in a certain area which was under discussion would be able to continue to sit at the table and share the expertise that they have. In your case, you're bringing expertise on the subject of subsistence, and we would want you to be able to offer that to the board as they discuss the subject of subsistence, for example. And then on the vote, you recuse yourself. Do you have an opinion about that idea?
I do think that's a good idea. Even if the board member cannot vote, a lot of times they're the most knowledgeable about the fishery in the area where we're meeting. I give several examples around the state of Alaska where that's happened. And I really think we would benefit from them at least sitting at the table and telling us they don't have to influence us anyway, but just providing information would be really good for the board process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Thank you, Senator Diesel. Additional questions? Okay. Yeah, Senator Wilson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Harrington. When's the last time that you were self-employed as a commercial fisherman?
It's been a long time. It's been so long. It was there was a commercial fishery in Galena, It was run by several people out of Anchorage, and they were flying fish out, and then I think my uncle took it over for a while. He's passed away, my uncle Sidney Huntington. He served on the board of game many years. He ran it for a while, and then some man named Terry ran it, and it just, economically, it just wasn't feasible. But I was really happy to see down in the Caltech that they set up a processing plant there, and they're making a go of it. That really made me happy to see. But as far as any farther up river, it's just not economically feasible for us to have a fishery.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Renton. And I also value your expertise as a wildlife biologist also being on the board. I think that also brings a different perspective than actual user group as well.
Thank you.
Okay. So thank you, Mr. Huntington. If you can stay online, we are going to take a few calls here. Some folks wanted to testify. So let's go ahead and go to public testimony at this point in time. It looks like we have let's go to Dillingham first. Norman Van Vector. Norman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Norman Van Vector. I'm in Dillingham, Alaska at the LIO office. For the most part, I'll keep this brief and short. I want to, again, thank Orville Huntington for his service to the state. I'm tickled pink to hear that he put his name back in for renomination. Again, he's a huge asset to the state. He's a dedicated public servant, and I certainly hope he gets all of our endorsement because the state needs people like Orville, and I'm very grateful for his service. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for that testimony. Still in Dillingham, Gary Klein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Klein. I live in Dillingham. I was raised here as a, I suppose, commercial sport and subsistence fisher. I enjoy all both. I have been a fairly new participant in the Board of Fish process within the last 3 years, and then I'm here to testify in support of Orville. Although I may not agree on every decision, I still feel that he uses the best information in front of him to make the most sound decision. And I would like to thank him for his service, and I would encourage you all to consider reappointing him to the Board of Fish. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay, so that's everybody in Dillingham. Let's go to Kenai. Another Gary Hollerer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Hollerer, Kenai, Alaska. I've attended every Board of Fish meeting, Upper Cook Inlet, since 1986, and I've seen a lot of Board of Fish members come and go. Mr. Huntington is definitely an asset. Make it short, echo the other sentiments. He's a good member and listens to the issues, and I'd like to see him reappointed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, also in Kenai, looks like, Paul Shadura.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. My name is Paul Shadura, and I reside here on the Kenai Peninsula. As a member of a longtime Alaskan family, I would like to offer my support for the reappointment confirmation to the Alaska Board of Fisheries of Orville Huntington. Orville has been on the Board of Fish since 2012 and is now considered a veteran of Cook Inlet regulatory meetings. It would be a misjustice to only consider his participation in South Central policy issues, as our state has many stakeholders, many regions, many cultures, many lives to consider. Orville has shown his skills as one who considers the resource first and the ramifications of management and policy decisions on the regional economies and traditional users. Mr. Huntington has extensive knowledge on subsistence needs and many in Alaska and is always available to consider the issues of food security. State law defines the qualifications of the Board of Fisheries as being of interest in public affairs, good judgment, knowledge, and ability in the field of action, diversity of interest, and points of view in the membership. What this means to me is that the state should be confirming individuals who have a different understanding of how best to manage state fisheries resources. Again, state law uses the term shall be appointed without political or geographical considerations. Orville exemplifies diversity. He has the scientific background to make decisions made on the best available science. He has the personal experience with working with Alaskans that rely on the fisheries resources for sustenance and the multiple years of supporting the economy while supplying food for residents and non-residents. The state is too big to tackle all fisheries issues with limited financial resources. The Board of Fisheries are severely hampered. They are volunteers and have no dedicated staff to help sort out the incredible amounts of knowledge they must review prior to and during a regulatory meeting. Further tightening of the ADF&G belt will result in a noose for many of the Board of Fish members and for all the resource residents of the state. In 1956, the idea of the Board of Fisheries and Game made sense. In the 70s, the board divided in order to be more efficient in their deliberations process. In the new millennia, 60 years later, maybe it's time that the legislature take another look on how we can make this process better, more efficient in addressing the fisheries issues of today and in the future. Good board members like Orville are hard to find. Maybe we're asking a bit too much from our current system of a seven-member board. The population has increased, critical demands on the resources are never-ending, and now we know so much more about the science that affects all our fisheries. The legislature should be less concerned about where a person comes from or how he's viewed on a single stakeholder issues and consider more about how the individual's wide array of knowledge and experiences will bring fair and transparent management policies now and into the future. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Paul, for that testimony. So is there anyone else online who wanted to testify? I show no one. So is there anyone here in Juneau who wants to testify? Okay, then we'll close the public testimony, and we'll go back to Mr. Huntington. Was there any additional questions after the testimony for Mr. Huntington? Nope. Okay, I think you're good, Mr. Huntington. Thank you very much for calling in and for your service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your service, too. God bless you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Okay, so again, same disclosure in accordance with AS 3905080, Senate State Affairs Committee reviewed the appointee, Mr. Huntington, and recommends appointment be forwarded to the joint session for consideration. And this does not reflect any intent by any member to vote for or against the confirmation of the individual during any further sessions. So, Christine, if you will go ahead and pass the book around so we can sign it. And let's go then to the next bill before us is Senate Bill 186. And we heard this bill March 8th. There was numerous questions. And I think that the Division of Elections has answered the questions. Of course, if committee members have questions on the answers or additional questions, we do have the director here. And we took the public testimony. So let's go back to the bill itself, and I'm going to invite the director to join us, please. Bring whatever lifelines you need there. Okay, so before we go into additional questions, was there anything else that you wanted to comment on or maybe some of the answers you gave us you'd like to elaborate a little bit more on? If so, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Chairman Meyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name's Josie Banky. I'm the director of the Division of Elections. Just want to say thank you for hearing the bill again today. We do have an amendment to go over, and just here to answer any questions you have with regards to our response and also the amendment.
Okay, very good. Let's hold on the amendment for now. And committee members, any questions for the director? at this time? Okay. Seeing none, or did you have one, Senator Collier?
No.
Okay. Okay. So I think what we'll do then is we have two amendments. We have yours and we have Senator Coghill's. So why don't we start with Senator Coghill. Would you like to move your amendment?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number one, which is the A.1 amendment.
Okay, and I'll object so you can hear your amendment.
Sure. And to the director's credit, she answered this question in part of the questions. It's just that I don't entirely agree with the answer, and that is whether or not the form would be better off to have somebody opt in. And as I stated before, the measure was meant to, the ballot measure was meant to register people to vote during the process of applying for a permanent fund dividend. And maybe I'll wait until the amendment gets in front of everybody.
Okay. Senator Geisel, do you not have it?
I will ask Christine for something in just a moment, but I do have the amendment.
You do have the amendment. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, very good.
I'll give my rationale for the amendment.
Okay.
I have not gone around and shopped this necessarily, but I just want to make a statement and a rationale for why I think this is important. If you go to the initiative language, as we have in our packet here on page one of the initiative, it gives six reasons for the intent of the initiative. And certainly it talks about the American democracy, the cornerstone is the right to vote. I get that. But if you look at number four, that's where it starts talking about the permanent fund dividend application. It says in the intent that the permanent fund dividend applicants who wish to register to vote or update their voter registration must submit information to the state second time using a different form. And so it starts off with that kind of permission, and I think that that's a big deal to me. But it says it can relieve the voters of a burden by having them complete that on the permanent fund dividend permanent fund dividend application. I think that's okay, and I think that the opt-in, opt-out is two very different ways of looking at it, and here's how I see the difference. The way that it was written is you would be automatically registered unless you opted out, and the division is asking for I'm sorry.
Let's take brief at ease. So I don't know. All right, we're back on the record. Senator Coghill, you were referring to the initiative.
Yes.
There was two things I was going to refer to, the ballot measure itself and the intent. But the intent, as people read it, the intent was to relieve qualified voters who apply for a PFD from the burden of having to complete additional paperwork. I think an opt-in still does that, and it's so well within the reason of our initiative. And I was going to read the Constitution to you on that particular issue because we have court cases, I get that, but we also have a Constitution, and I'm willing to challenge it. It says in Article 11, Section 6, about halfway down, it says, you know, after it's not subject to veto and may not be repealed at any time, I mean, may not be repealed by the legislature within 2 years of the effective date, it may be amended at any time. A very explicit language in the Constitution. Very clear, very plain. It may not be repealed, but it may be amended. And I see this as an amendment. As you can look at their answer, they see this as a more than that. It would probably go to court. And I have a legal opinion that says we think that it might and we think that it might not. So, and, you know, that's an open question. If you look at the initiative language, the opt-out doesn't even come to page 3. And it's at the top of page 3 in subsection 3. If applicant does not decline to be registered and failure to respond to the notification on sub B. So for those who see the intent, have to dig pretty deep before they get to that. Now, it is true that in the ballot measure language, they combine two things in the last sentence, and if I might read it to you, Mr. Chairman, the statement of support, the last sentence says, new voters will receive a notification in the mail to either declare a political affiliation or opt out of the voter registration process. So it does say that after two pretty good significant paragraphs, but it also says for a small change, our state can reap huge benefits, and these benefits are three. One, make government more efficient and save taxpayer dollars. Two, voter databases become more accurate and secure. And three, every eligible voter gets an equal opportunity to have their voice heard in our democracy. And that's what people are going to pay attention to. And so I think it's well within our reason. So the courts have several different tests that they're going to go through. I get that. And I just wanted to make the case that the burden should the burden of the willingness to vote still belongs to the voter. There should not be a presumption on the government that they will vote or they are registered to vote. There should be a presumption that the individual chooses to vote. And the next thing we're going to talk about is sending notices back and forth. All you have to do is say, I want to register to vote, just like you do on your your car registration. It's just a simple, I want to register to vote. This way, you have to actually get information back, and they're trying to change that to say, I want to opt out. It's an awkward way of doing it. So to me, the burden, if you will, or the least restrictive means to the individual would be just opt in. The least restrictive to the government is you got to opt out. And so I just err on the side, or I fall on the side of having the least restrictive means to the individual. That's just me. So that's my argument, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
And I know it will be fought somewhat by the – I met with these two fine folks in my office today. I just said I'd make my case.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Senator Coghill. And Senator Coghill, did you say you have a legal opinion that the amendment is –
I have a legal opinion that should have been brought to go out with my amendment.
I do,
what it says, we think it may and we think it may not. That's what they basically say.
Okay.
So, and I think it may not be a problem.
Senator Giesel, did you?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Coghill moved his amendment. Someone objected for purposes of discussion. So could I ask that Senator Coghill explain his amendment, you know, it kind of like a sectional analysis, perhaps?
Yep.
Just to make sure that I understand what the amendment is doing.
Senator Coghill.
So if you look at Section 1, we're taking the bill section on page 1, and we're going down to, on the amendment, line 13, we're requesting to be registered as a voter as the operative. So now we're going to say you're going to check a box requesting to be a voter. So instead of completing just a permanent fund form, and then so then the other sections are conforming until you get to let's see. So if you look on page 2 of the amendment, requesting registration is, once again, other than completing the form, it's requesting. Mm-hmm. So it's affirmative. And so the same thing on page 2, line 1, page 2, line 4, request, and we're going to take delete declines to, and then who request to be registered does not. So what you're doing is taking the negative out. And then page 2, line 12, on 25 of this second page, who requested registration of the applicant's registration status following the applicant word. It's inserting the positive, basically. And the same thing on page 2, line 13 and 14. You're deleting the applicant's registration status, mainly because the registration is presumed until you say no. And so the registration status is open for question until you respond back to the Division of Elections. And then the big question is on page 3 of this amendment, and you can see very clearly then we've deleted if the applicant does not decline, and does not decline in page 3, line 3, we put requests. It's simpler, it's cleaner, it's positive, it's a positive action by the individual, it saves money, you know, all that stuff. So, and the same thing is true in now section 6, which is on lines 12 through 21 on page 3. This is the attestation that you're able to register to vote. This is section 6. The means for an applicant eligible to vote under this statute, or a person authorized on behalf of the applicant to request that applicant be registered to vote, has to attest. And so we have a self-attestation in Alaska, and that's what this was following suit on. And the declining is once again deleted on page 3, line 3 through 5, as you see there. And the request, once again, is reasserted in page 3, line 11, unrequested to register to vote. So they're all pretty much conforming to that request. So it really is changing the opt-out to the opt-in. And I get that it'll be a question. It may even be litigated. But here's what I fall on the side of. I fall on the side of an individual should have the right to say, I want to vote, instead of saying, you know, I'm already registered, I don't want to be registered. And to me, that is a better civics thing. And once again, the burden falls on the voter to register. I get that. But the presumption doesn't go to the state, it goes to the voter, which I prefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that explanation.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Geisel. Yes. It's a opt-in rather than opt-out, right, as it currently is. Okay. Okay, very good. So I'm sure the director has another thought and your legal assistance there. So, director, I'll give the floor to you or to whoever you want to give it to.
Okay. Chairman Meyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Libby Bacalar. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. As Senator Coghill mentioned, Director Behnke and I did meet with the senator previously prior to this hearing. I have reviewed the memo from Legislative Council, and I agree with it overall. The germane sentence in Mr. Bullard's memo is that there exists a possibility that requiring an applicant to opt in could be interpreted by a court as so significant a change to the initiated law that it functions as a repeal of 15 PFVR, which is the ballot initiative of that was enacted in the 2016 general election. In my view, that outcome is more likely than not, because the core intent behind the initiative was to create an automatic voter registration process. The opt-out provisions are sort of the heart of that process, and I think that the Supreme Court would more likely than not reach the conclusion that this type of amendment prior to March of 2019 would constitute an unconstitutional repeal of the bill. So Mr. Buller has correctly identified the core legal issue. I think that, yes, he's saying maybe, maybe not. I think more maybe yes, based on what I'm reading, and specifically in Section 5 of the initiative, what I understood the sponsor's intent to be, my understanding from working with the sponsor's post-enactment, that this is really all about the opt-out process. And with respect to Senator Coghill's concerns about where the burden falls on the state versus the government, this is something that the people enacted, the people voted for it. So we have no choice, really, but to assume that this is what the people want, is to have this automatic opt-out process. Now, I think were Senator Coghill's amendment to be adopted, I think the amendment is sufficiently deviant from the core of the intent of the initiative that a court, if this were litigated, would more likely than not find this to be effectively a repeal of the measure. So that's my legal opinion.
Good. Very good. Thank you. Senator Coghill, anything?
Yeah, we had this conversation, and as you can see from the legal opinion, a lot of it is what-if language. It's not very emphatic, and so I get that. And I don't see it going to the heart of it, because the heart of it was to make it easier for people to register. In fact, if you go back and listen to all the advertisements that happened, it was really centered on it makes it easy for you to register to vote, and it should be on your PFD. And then just simply say, okay, I want to register on the PFD, seems cleaner, clearer, and less expensive. So I don't think it goes outside of the realm of either the ballot measure language or the actual legislative intent in the language of the thing. So it does change some of that, but I think our constitutional duty is very, very clear that we may amend it at any time. And so I think this is a proper amendment. It does speak to a core issue, but it doesn't change, I think, the core of the expectation of the initiative. So that's just my argument. We just fundamentally disagree on this. It's a reasonable argument both ways, but that's where I fall.
So thank you, Senator Coghill. So if I may ask the legal counsel, we can't amend it, can we, for 2 years? Isn't that the...
Chairman Meyer, you may amend it at any time. You may not repeal it before 2 years. But what the case law says is that some amendments are so significant that they vitiate, is the word the Supreme Court uses, so vitiate the initiative as to constitute effectively a repeal of the initiative.
And you believe that's the case with this amendment?
Chairman Meyer, yes, I do.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
I, Mr. Chairman, think that it falls right square in the intent, and that is the idea of using a permanent fund dividend as a place to apply for a voter registration. That was the core intent, and this makes it so easy. All you have to do is say, yes, I want to register to vote. So that's the difference of opinion we have.
Okay,
very good. That's my amendment.
All right. any members, any other questions, thoughts? Okay. Well, you know, Senator Coghill, as much as I would like to support your amendment, because I think it is the better way to go, I guess I would agree with the director and legal counsel that, you know, voters need to read through the whole initiative very carefully, because obviously there were some things that passed, as we know, in the marijuana initiative that I'm not sure voters knew or didn't know. They just wanted to legalize marijuana. So, I'm going to maintain my objection, but I don't know. Other committee members, any other thoughts? Okay, then let's go ahead and take a roll.
Amendment 1,
Senator Wilson? Yes. Senator Pizzo?
Yes.
Senator Egan?
Yes.
Senator Coghill?
Yes.
Chair Meyer?
Nope.
4 yeas, 1 nay. Okay, so amendment number 1, Senator Coghill's amendment does pass. So, what does that do now to amendment 2, Director? Because do you still want to move amendment 2?
Yes, please.
Okay. All right. All right. I guess I move amendment two. Okay. So amendment two, do you want to move that, Senator Giesen?
Sure. Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number two. It doesn't have a legal drafting number. It simply says at the top, AM-2SB186. The date on it is 03-07-2018.
Okay. And I'll object so that we can hear what amendment two does. Okay. Go ahead, Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On page two, line two, delete an eligible. This is to provide an area of clarity and to streamline the voter registration process with regards to eligibility of a PFD applicant and a registered voter. And this was needed because we don't know if one is eligible at the time they come in the door to apply for a PFD. And so this we saw as a necessary change to clarify that. Page 2, line 3, following applicant, we inserted reference to a PFD statute, and that was basically for conformity by adding reference to that statute. Page 2, line 9, delete upon, then insert. This basically clarifies how the opt-out process will work in practice and sets opt-out standards for the director and allows the director to come up with procedures. Page 2, lines 12 and 13, we added this back in. It was originally deleted, but we added it back in, not already registered to vote, because the division will want to provide newly registered voters a voter card. So eliminated the necessity of a mailer, but we want to add back in not already registered to vote, because we still will want to mail them a new voter card.
Okay.
And then finally, page 3, line 5, allows the division director to adopt regulations.
Okay. All right, Senator Caulfield.
So, because of the opt-out debate, certainly the lines 8 through 14 are not going to work in this bill. So, what is necessary in this particular amendment for you to manage, for example, the not already registered to vote? So let's go through this and find out, based on the amendment we just did, what is absolutely necessary for you to do to make it smoother, or is there anything based on the amendment? Nothing, right, at this point?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, Libby Backler from Department of Law for the record. I do think the passage of the previous amendment will probably sort of moot the reason for this piece of the amendment. I would have to, it's hard for me to visualize without a CS in front of me. I kind of need to look at the CS with both amendments together to see what works and what doesn't work, because it's hard for me to picture it all in pieces. But certainly this part of the amendment that we're looking at that you've, Senator Coghill, have identified, lines 8 through 14 on page 1 of our amendment here, certainly is implicated by the amendment that just passed. And so because it goes to the opt-out procedures, if there is no opt-out procedure in the bill anymore, then I don't know that this piece is needed, because the whole reason for this piece was to facilitate and streamline the opt-out procedure. So if the amendment is to do away with the opt-out, then I don't necessarily think, and again, I'll qualify my response by saying I would need to see the CS and consult with Ledge Legal and my colleagues, et cetera, but I don't think this piece of the amendment would be necessarily needed anymore, because it does go to the whole opt-out concept, and if that concept is removed from the bill, then I don't think we'll likely need that piece.
Mr. Chairman, based on that, I would like to reject the amendment, but have them come back to things that they think they needed to have for the better operation. Because it looks like there are pieces in here that may be helpful to them. I just don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, so why don't we do that? Why don't we hold this bill for now and order up a CS with the new amendment one. Obviously, that did change the bill significantly, or it changed it. And I think there is still some cleanup that needs to be done with your amendment two, but it is different than what you have offered thus far. So, Senator Giesel.
Mr. Chairman, therefore, should I withdraw my motion to adopt amendment number two, or should I make a motion to table amendment number two?
Well, I think we could do it either way. Yeah, I see the recording secretary nodding his head. So we can just leave it as moved and no action taken, and we'll pick it up. Once we have the CS, then we'll pick up Amendment 2 and see if we still need it. Although Amendment 2 is going to be different. So you'll probably withdraw Amendment 2 at that point in time. Okay. Clear as mud?
Yes.
All right, good. Okay, so with that, let's hold this bill until we get the committee substitute, and then we'll look forward to your amendment to the committee substitute. Thank you, Director.
Thank you.
All right, let's move on now to the next item, and that is House Bill 31, Sexual Assault Training and Exam Kits and Domestic Violence. I think the sponsor may be on the floor. Are you? Okay, great. Are you Diana? Okay, perfect. Diana, if you want to come on up. Let's take a brief at ease. We'll come back to order. Again, we are taking up House Bill 31, Sexual Assault Training, and we do have the sponsor, Representative Tarr, is here, as well as her trusty staff, Diana Rhodes. So with that, if you could put your name on the record, please, and tell us what your bill does.
Thank you, Chair Meyer and members of the committee. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from Anchorage, joined by my staff, Diana Rhodes, who's been doing an amazing job on this. So I have to thank her for her great work, and thank you to all of you for scheduling the hearing today on this important bill. We have been working on the issues related to how we process our sexual assault kits for the last few years, starting in 2014 when I was contacted by a national organization called End the Backlog, and it was an issue I was not familiar with. But through their organization, learned about this effort, and basically across the country, there are these sexual assault kits that have not been tested. There's a variety of reasons that's been the case in the past, but it's been thousands and thousands of kits, and there's become a sort of a movement around reforming how we deal with these kits and basically using it as a tool to address serial sexual assaulters, and that's what it's been found to be very helpful in accomplishing. We started out with a bill related to an audit. That was the first piece of information that we needed to try and understand the extent of the problem in Alaska. At the same time, the Federal Department of Justice started offering some grants because this issue took on a sort of a national impact, and so they were offering these grants. So then at that time, the governor's office applied for one of the grants. So there's kind of two things happening at once. Then once those grant dollars were received by the state, the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, or SAKI, was formed, and we've been working closely with them and trying to unravel where the problems are in Alaska and what we can do to address those issues. And there are several different things that we could choose to work on at this time, but we've confined it to a few items right now because these are things that we can make changes to pretty immediately. and continue working with Asaki for more long-term changes that we think will result in a much better system that functions well and make sure it keeps the public safe. So this particular bill addresses three components. One is the audit, and that piece was thankfully put into Senate Bill 55, so we got the first audit last year, but it continues and has that same provision in it so that we can get an annual update of the status of the kits and the progress in Alaska. And that audit, I would say, was really, really helpful for us this year because what it did was help us define sort of the universe of untested kits. How many are out there? Where are they? And kind of get everybody on the same page because now we can actually come up with a plan of how we're going to address the backlog of untested kits. And so the audit provision remains, and I think that's just an important way for the state to get updated, the legislature to get updated on the progress, and on an annual basis have a number that we're working off of so that we know progress is being made. We've worked closely with the department on that provision, and my understanding is that they feel like that can be easily implemented as an ongoing thing, that because we did it through Senate Bill 55, again, thank you to Senator Coghill for that, last year, the infrastructure is in place to continue that on that annual basis. And at some point, that may not be necessary, but I think it's going to be a multi-year effort here for us to continue working on this, and it'll keep us getting accurate information. So one piece is the audit. A second piece is related to sexual assault training for law enforcement officials. Most folks in Alaska go through either the academy in Anchorage or the Trooper Academy, unless there's someone who perhaps comes in, you know, does a lateral transfer or something. But most of our folks are going to come through those two academies. But right now, what the statute says is it requires the 12 hours for training on domestic violence, but it doesn't specify that there's also training required on sexual assault response. And even though that's happening in practice, the recommendation to include this actually came from the folks who are working on this. That way it's clear that it should be both domestic violence and sexual assault. There are ways that those can be the same information because, of course, domestic violence situation could involve a sexual assault, but there are also instances where that's different. And what we want to ensure that we have a good victim-centered approach, and so that if someone is assaulted, it doesn't matter whether it happened in northern Alaska or southeast Alaska, that there's going to be a strong victim-centered approach and that everybody's going to get the same response and treatment. So that is what that second provision hopes to accomplish. And then the third provision is related to the actual options for a victim to report. About a year ago, now the Federal Department of Justice released a white paper on this very provision. And there's a couple ways to look at this. And this sort of took me a little bit to wrap my head around, because when you start working on this and you see what some of the results have been in other states, there's a strong motivation to say every single kit needs to be tested because that individual could be a dangerous criminal and we want to get them off our streets. However, we have to make sure, again, that we have a victim-centered approach, and it isn't always the case that a victim wants to engage in law enforcement. And so we really do have to make sure that we have an opportunity for them to have the kit taken or collected, evidence collected, because it has to be done in a timely fashion. If it's not done within about 72 hours, then your evidence collection isn't going to be useful. So unfortunately, you have someone who's just experienced a very traumatic situation that has to go in for an invasive medical procedure to do the examination and collect the evidence, and might not be the right time for them to make the decision about where they want to go. Do they want to pursue a case with law enforcement, or do they want to just make sure they don't have health issues as a result of this assault or STD testing, things like that. So because you have that limited window of time when you can do the collection, having a couple different options is the best way to make sure that the individual who experienced the assault can choose what works for them. And so what we put in, and you'll notice in the original version, there are actually three different opportunities for a victim. And in working with the department and through the SAKI that's been going on, we've been able to decide that this number two can come out. And that just as you look at it, what looks like number three, one and three would be the two that remain. So you'd have the option of getting the evidence collected and choosing to engage with law enforcement right at that moment. And you'd have the second option of an anonymous report. And that allows you to choose at a later date whether you want to engage with law enforcement or not. And we're told that often the individual does choose to move forward but needs a little bit of space from that whole experience to just, you know, kind of be able to get a support network around them, be able to work with, you know, the people who are trained to provide that kind of response, the trauma response, and, you know, once feel a little bit more secure, more safe, more stable, that they know that, that's something that, they can move forward with, then make that choice. But you haven't missed that window of opportunity when you can actually collect as evidence that would be usable. So those are the two options that are allowed for that. So those are the three parts that are in the bill now. Some of the other provisions that people may want to consider in the future are a timeline within which all the kits have to be tested. That was one thing we considered. Also, from the folks who've been working on this nationally, they are really pushing for a way for a victim to be able to track where their kit is. So that's something we might consider at a later date. So there are a couple of those other pieces out there that you may have heard of in the conversation. That's why I want to mention them today. But these ones are confined to the items that the department has said they can do at this time without a fiscal impact, which is really important to the work we're all trying to accomplish in developing our sustainable fiscal plan, but can be meaningful. And I think that's really important. I know Senator Meyer, and I thank you for your leadership on sexual assault issues and always acknowledging April Sexual Assault Awareness Month. This is something we try to work together on, and so I'm encouraged that there is an option here where we can make meaningful changes that could have a positive impact, but also aware of our fiscal situation right now, you know, don't have a big price tag attached to them. I think that's all I have
okay.
at this time.
Yeah, that's pretty good. So I just have one question, or we'll open up the questions, and then maybe you or your staff can go through the sectional, although I think you pretty much did. Mm-hmm. So how many untested kits? I mean, I joined you with that movie. Thank mm-hmm. you for putting that on, and Senator Coghill as well. Mm-hmm. And some of these cities had untested kits, you know, 5,000, 10,000. And I noticed here in what you wrote that the last time you checked there was like 3,400 untested kits. What do you have an updated number? Or is that
Chair Meyer, that is the kind of the number we're working from right now. What is happening is we're sort of transitioning into where we're sending out batches of those to be tested. But because there was a big push from the federal government and some grant dollars available, now there's actually a backlog at the facilities that do the testing because a lot of states are trying to move forward with this effort. So we're getting our batches in, and the folks from DPS could probably give better information, but I believe the first batch was just sent out in about the last month. Sometime in February, I think, is when we're going to start being able to cycle ours in. So it's going to take some time. We will need in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to test all of those eventually. So we're working through the dollars we have available from the federal grant, and that's why I think that audit can be really helpful, because we'll be working through, and then, of course, there may be prosecutions as a result of that. So it's going to be an ongoing process, but hopefully we can continue to work together on that.
Thank you. And, yeah, thank you for your leadership in this area, too. Oftentimes we get asked, what's our favorite bill that we ever got passed, and mine was when we were able to drop the statute of limitations on rape and sexual assault. But mm-hmm. unfortunately, that was in 2001 or 2002. So anything prior to that, you know, we can't go after. But still, you know, we can, and you know, with these kits and with DNA, and you know, we're able to go back 10, 15, 20 years or more. Mm-hmm. Okay. So questions from the committee, Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you. During my time as a director of a DVSA program, we restarted the SART program out in the Mat-Su, mm-hmm. and working with the SART team there, we already had these protocols in place in terms of anonymous reporting, and so I just didn't know if that was a part of the statute that was, is this just needed to help that sort of, I'm trying to understand the need for the anonymous reporting in statute versus what's already been currently in practice. I just didn't know if there's an issue that's happening out there or not. And I mean, that's sort of a DPS type question. I know that they still funded folks that wanted to have SART kits ran for the anonymous process. So I didn't know if that was a a new issue that's now coming up or not, or I'll let you.
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, what we hope to accomplish is to have a standard statewide policy. And as what's been explained to me, and that relates also to why we want to put the 12 hours of training in, is that there's, you know, over 200 law enforcement agencies in the state of Alaska. And so in some cases, people are doing things just a little bit different from the next. And by having that standard policy, it will ensure that everybody is getting that opportunity.
Okay.
Anything else, Senator Wilson?
Yeah, and
go ahead.
If I could, please. Representative Tarr, I guess my other question is trying to get the number of the actual untested rate kits. I know that we heard testimony during the subcommittee and DPS upon the process of where they were, and I don't have those notes here with me, just trying to understand the numbers of the actual rape kits. I know that in 2017, I guess that would be helpful. I don't know if they're online to testify today or not, they can answer sort of the process of where they're actually at today with some of these kits and testing and funding. And
I don't think we have anybody from Department of Safety. Oh, yeah, we do. We do, actually.
I mean, that's a question that we can ask for them at that time, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. And then my last question, if I may.
Yeah, please.
Would be if in Senate Bill 55, was that audit language just for that 1 year, for just last year, and this is the annual?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And through the chair to Senator Wilson, in your packet should be the report that was given to the legislature on November 1st of 2017, and this was the piece we were able to accomplish as the single year audit. But this is where it states that there are 3,484 sexual assault kits inventoried, 3,219 were in the possession of the seven largest agencies, and so that's the number that we're working off of right now. The SOCI grant allows a portion of the grant money to be used to test kits, and under these grants, 571 sexual assault kits were identified as eligible for testing, and those are the ones that are going to be sent outside to the contractor.
Okay. Anything else, Senator Wilson?
Not this time.
Okay, very good. Okay, I don't think we need to do a sectional because you pretty much did that. So if there's no questions from committee members, why don't we go into public testimony? And well, first of all, let me go. Well, there are some invited testimony here. We have some folks from public safety in the crime lab, and I know one of the questions that Senator Wilson had, hopefully one of the folks from the crime lab can answer. I show an Orrin and a Randy. Which one would like to take Senator Wilson's question?
This is Orrin Dim. I'm the Chief Forensic Laboratories with the Alaska Department of Public Safety Crime Laboratory in Anchorage, Alaska, for the record. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, can I have that question again, please?
Yeah, just currently, I know we talked about a month or so ago, but just trying to get an update of where the numbers are now for the unprocessed kits. I guess if you have that updated number, that would be wonderful.
Yes. So through the chair, Senator Wilson, so we did provide the number in our report, and what I can say is we have sent 300 kits so far to the contract vendor for analysis. We have not received any of those kits back yet, so they are not yet completed. We have another 132 kits staged ready to go. Our vendor did request that we delay sending those because they ran out of space to put kits. So for us, we have 432, if you will, scheduled to go to the vendor. We will be waiting to see whether or not we run out of money with those kits as to whether or not we can continue to send kits.
If I
go ahead,
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
How do you set a prioritize which kits get sent out?
So through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'm actually going to turn that over to Ms. Randy Brieger because she has been on that committee involved in that process.
Okay.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Randy Brieger. I'm the criminal justice planner with the Department of Public Safety Crime Lab. Through the chair, we established basically a triage protocol to identify how we were going to send kits and in what order, knowing that we might possibly run out of funds before we can test all 571 eligible kits. We prioritized first based on cases that had an unknown suspect or a stranger assault, essentially. Our next priority were all sexual abuse of minor cases. The next step was any suspect that had more than 10 incidents in their criminal history, and that goes beyond sexual assault, so they could have a number of different other crimes attributed to them. Our next one were known suspects but not in CODIS yet, and then our final category was kind of a mix of all the remaining kits. Did that answer your question, sir?
Yes, but then it added an additional question. I'm sorry,
okay,
Mr.
Go
Chair.
Ahead. Go ahead,
So only 571 are eligible kits. So I guess out of the 3,000, does that mean that we have to test those ourselves here in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, no, that's a great clarification point. So the 571 kits are actually only Department of Public Safety Alaska State Trooper kits. So what we did with this grant was we applied first isolating Alaska State Trooper cases because they are within the jurisdictional control of the Department of Public Safety. And we are utilizing it as sort of a pilot project, if you will, because it's taking an immense amount of resources for personnel and time to organize this project. And we knew that the smaller departments would not have the resources to be able to dedicate to that level of a project. So we're hoping by us going through this process that we will be able to provide policy recommendations, best practices, templates, et cetera, for all of the smaller departments to copy and implement. They could choose to go apply for grant funds on their own, or we can continue to have conversations about what it might look like for the state to help with that.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Wilson. Well, since Orrin and Randy both are on the record, did you have anything that you wanted to, did you want to testify on the bill or just primarily answer questions?
Through the chair, I think Representative Tarr did an excellent job explaining the bill step by step, and we didn't have anything to add. She worked very closely with us throughout the process, and I think she did a great job summarizing all of the feedback from multiple different agencies.
Okay, very good. Thank you. So I've kept my committee here till 5 o'clock, but they are willing to continue for the public testimony because I know a lot of you have been online since 3:30. So we will go into testimony now. I would ask, though, that you try to stay within the 2 to 3 minute range. And let me go first to Keely Olson with STAR. Is Keely still online?
Can you hear me?
Yep. We were on mute, weren't we?
Thank you so much.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you so much to the chair and thank you to the committee. I, too, have nothing further as far as testimony except to say that I was invited to testify on behalf of STAR, Standing Together Against Rape, here in Anchorage, as well as the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and that testimony would be in support of the bill with the included amendments as very concisely described by Representative Tarr. So I have nothing further unless you have some questions. And I did understand that there was one question regarding the number of sexual assault kits that were currently being performed statewide. And my understanding from the sponsor statement is that there were 413 kits submitted in the calendar year of 2017. Approximately 235 of those occurred in Anchorage, which is STAR's jurisdiction.
Okay, good. Thanks. Thank you for that update. Hopefully we'll get them all tested here relatively soon. Okay, so let's go now to online and We have some folks here from out of state. Let's go to Nancy Porto. Nancy, if you could put your name.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yep, sure can. Put your name, please, on the record for us.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nancy Porto. Should I continue with testimony?
Yes, please do. Yes.
Okay, so my name is Nancy Porto. I lived in Alaska for over 20 years. Even though I recently moved to Washington State, Alaska is where I grew up, and it is where I call home. Today, I'm representing myself in support of House Bill 31. 2 years ago, I gave the following testimony in front of the 29th State Legislature for HB 117. This coming Easter marks a two-year timeline from now and the time that I experienced a sexual assault. Although I went to the hospital and police as soon as I was able and fully consented to a full rape kit examination, the kit has still not been fully processed. I am still waiting on the biological evidence portion of my exam. That was my testimony verbatim given 2 years ago in support of HB 117. Today, the only thing that I can say has changed is that this Easter now marks the five-year anniversary of my sexual assault. The biological DNA portion of my rape kit still remains untested. I'm going to get a little bit personal here, but over 6 months after my assault, I learned that there was no sperm from the rape kit. That is very important because it told me that I woke up before the man was able to rape me. That, thankfully, all I woke up to feeling touch me was most likely just his hands. Over a year and a half after my assault, I learned the results of my blood panel. A year and a half, I finally had the validation and confirmation that I was drugged. When I called the number provided to me 5 years ago on my patient discharge instructions, it goes to voicemail. I leave messages and I don't receive callbacks. It's now 2018, 5 years later, and I am still waiting. I am asking you to please support this bill because I am tired of calling. Please support House Bill 31 and help provide me and others who have experienced this closure. Thank you for listening.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for your testimony, Nancy. Sorry you've had to wait so long. Okay, let's go on now to Cassandra Humphrey. Cassandra, if you could put your name on the record for us, please.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Cassandra Humphrey. I'm actually the sister to Nancy Porto, who just spoke. I'm currently living in California, but I was also born and raised in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm representing myself in support of House Bill 31. I hope my personal account can simply support the need for action in regard to this processing of these kits. More than half of my friends and three of my extended family members and my sister have all been raped while living in Alaska. None of them received any kind of justice, and most of them didn't even report the rape. The reason for not being reported is a reoccurring theme. I keep hearing it's not like the police will do anything about it, followed by why should I go through all the public ridicule when I know nothing will happen to him. I myself was molested in Alaska. I reported the incident, but I also did not press charges for similar reasons. I was already facing ridicule from the committee, and I knew that my case would just sit in the system. After I came forward, four other women confessed that they were molested by the same man, and again, none of them went to the police because of the same reasons. It's bad enough that victims have to face ridicule in the committee. It's even worse that they know the police are not there to support them and make the victims feel safe and validated. My sister, she said her kit has been sitting on a shelf for 5 years, unprocessed now. She reported her incident of sexual assault thinking she would get some form of justice, but on top of the trauma she suffered, she now lives with a persistent anxiety of this lingering criminal case, and it has made it very difficult for her to move forward. I feel the system has completely failed her. We were talking about some statistics earlier. It's reported that Alaska crime rates, sexual crime rates, are three times higher than the national average.
and child sexual assault rates are 6 times higher than the national average. We have a justice system that's providing no justice to the victims of these crimes, and predators are going to continue to commit these crimes because there's no follow-through put in place. It's a common trend we can see in crime mapping that when accountability is less, people are not afraid to commit the crimes. Subsequently, these crimes go up. So it's not shocking to see that Alaska sexual crime rate, crime rates are so astronomically high. And our average is, reflecting this because we have over 3,000 rape kits that have gone untested since 2000. I urge all of you to vote yes on House Bill 31 so we can hopefully put a stop to this vicious cycle and provide some justice to all these victims. The untested kits need to be processed, and the predators need to know that they'll be held accountable for these crimes. Victims also need to know that their crimes will get a real response from the justice system. And hopefully, in turn, sexual crimes will eventually decrease in Alaska. I would never dream of raising any of my future children in Alaska, with one big reason being it is so saturated with sexual crime. I hope one day Alaska can at least match the national average, and hopefully by working on these bills and getting them passed, we can head that direction. Thank you, Senate State Affairs and Committee, and Mr. Chair, for letting me testify.
Absolutely. Thank you for your testimony. Okay, let's move on now to Janice Johnson in Valdez. Still with us, Janice? Are we on mute, Janice?
Hello?
Yeah, there you are. Okay. Janice, if you could put your name on the record and proceed with the testimony, please.
My name is Janice Johnson. I live in Valdez, Alaska. I've been a resident of Alaska for over 35 years, and for the last 20 years have been involved in the support of victims of sexual assault. I strongly support the passage of HB 31. I won't reiterate the excellent coverage that other people have already testified. But this backlog compromises prosecution, and it allows perpetrators to continue at large and repeat their assaults and reoffend. This is just devastating to victims, and the backlog has to be addressed. Law enforcement agencies need to be accountable for these kits and so that the Justice Department can prosecute. Please take this issue seriously. It affects many, many people in our state.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony, Janice.
You're welcome. Thank you for serving.
Thank you for staying with us. Okay, let's go to the Anchorage LAO, and it looks like we have Bessie Odam. But Bessie, if you're still with us, if you put your name on the record, please.
Hello, my name is Bessie Odam, and I live in House District 28. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I'm encouraging you all to vote yes on HB 31, not only because it is the right thing to do, but because victims of sexual assault deserve justice, and they deserve the protection of the law. It is time now to take the proper procedures to ensure that victims of said violence are able to get the closure they need and that they deserve. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Bessie, for that testimony. Sally Ports, are you there, please? Sally, are you? Oh, yep. Okay, can you speak up a little bit, please?
For the record?
Yeah, can you get a little closer to the mic, or maybe we turn up the volume? You're hard to hear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
There you go.
And committee. For the record, my name is Sally Porto. Those were my two daughters that spoke earlier. I live in House District 21 and am representing myself. Today I am testifying in support of House Bill 31. a little on my history. I am Alaskan, raised in the Bush communities, and from high school to present, I have been living in Anchorage. I only have two adult children. Both have been affected by trauma through sexual assault, as well as myself. In my childhood, I was quite young. Our family is shadowed every Easter with the tragic violation that occurred 5 years ago, and to date, no action has been taken by the state authorities to have resolved in my family. My child took and followed advice from the authorities given, and the system has failed her. We must step up and help those that have been traumatized by these horrible acts that have been forced on our people. Again, for my family, we are approaching our fifth Easter with no resolve. I urge you to support House Bill 31, and please hear our voices. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Sally. Okay, Catherine Homan. Catherine, are you still with us? Catherine? Catherine, are you still there? If not, we can try back in a few minutes. Are you on? Maybe you're on mute. That happens sometimes.
No, she's on mute.
She is on mute?
She's on mute.
Oh, she's on mute. Okay. So, Catherine, are you there? We'll check back later. Let's go back to Juno now. Was there anyone here in the room that wanted to testify? Yes, please come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jane Andreen, and I'm here testifying in support of the bill, both for on behalf of the Alaska Women's Lobby, but also personally. And I'd like to share just a little bit about why I'm here. I received my first sexual assault training in Winona, Minnesota in 1977. The state of Minnesota had just formed its first sexual assault office and sent down two women to train us in a one-day workshop. I was really grateful to have that information because 2 years later, on July 9th, 1979, as I was walking back to my car that evening from swimming at the local sand pits, I was attacked from someone behind and raped. I knew by the time I drove home that what I needed to do was contact the police and make a report, that was the first opportunity that I had to start to regain some control over my life. And it took about 7 hours to go through the rape exam, go through the hospital, go through the police interview, et cetera, et cetera. To this day, I have never received any word on whether or not I assume they haven't made an arrest or what the results of my rape exam were. But it did lead to me making a major change in my life, which was to move to Alaska 4 months later. And 3 years after that, in 1982, I started working in the areas of domestic violence and sexual assault. I'm very pleased to say that while in Homer, as the director of South Peninsula Women's Services, we worked with South Peninsula Hospital to bring the first SART-SANE training to Alaska. And then when I took over as the director of the State Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault in 94, I was able to play a role in helping to expand that team approach across the state. I've dedicated a lot of my life to this issue and wanting to make it be much more victim-centered and much more empowering, as well as to be an effective tool in making arrests and holding offenders accountable. After I retired from the state about 18 months ago, I was working with one of the local programs on contract doing a needs assessment. And as part of that, I looked into the state data that we have, statewide data. And I just wanted to share for 2015, our Alaska Victimization Survey that's conducted by the University of Alaska Justice Center reported that 7,662 adult Alaskan women were raped in the year of 2015. At that same time, we look at the Uniform Crime Report, which is the reports that were made to law enforcement. There were 895 confirmed reports. So you go from 7,600 down to 895. And of those 895, only 130 arrests were actually made. This is a crime that represents between 10 and 20% of our violent crimes that are reported in Alaska every year, and yet we have the lowest conviction rate. We need this tool. I often wonder, because rapists are repeat offenders more often than not, how many other women were affected by that man who attacked me, and what we could do if we could get this backlog cleared off. I really want to commend Representative Tarr for the work that she's doing and the dedication, and also for the work that I know that you have done individually and as a legislature. But for these reasons, I think it's really important to support this bill and move these tests, these kits forward. Thank you.
Very good. Is there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, is there anyone else here in Juneau? Okay, very good. Come on up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Allison Curry. I'm the legislative liaison with Planned Parenthood Votes here in Alaska and also a Juneau resident. And I'm here today in strong support of HB 31 and also want to express my appreciation for Rep. Tarr and her leadership on this issue. I don't have much more to add than those who testified before me, but would like to thank those who testified and shared their personal stories. I think it's been made pretty clear that this bill would have a direct positive impact for victims of sexual assault in our state who are waiting for closure and justice. So do appreciate your vote yes on this important legislation. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Allison. Questions? Seeing none. Okay. Anybody else want to testify? Anybody here in Juneau want to testify? Okay. Very good. And then is there anyone else online? There is, speak up. Okay, and if by chance, I know one person did change her mind, but if you want to send in your testimony, we'd be happy to take it. So feel free to send that to us. Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and close the public testimony if there's no one else to testify. And we'll bring the bill back before us. We do have one amendment. Is this the sponsor? Why don't you join us, please? Okay, Senator Giesel?
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number 1, version 30LS0271/Omega 2 before the committee.
Okay, and I'll object so we can hear the amendment and why it's necessary. If you could put your name on the record again, please.
For the record, I'm Diana Rhodes. I'm staff to Representative Tarr. Thank you for bringing forward this amendment. We, earlier this year, Representative Tarr met with victim advocates and the Department of Public Safety to talk about, as we mentioned, the three reporting options and the need to remove the middle reporting option. We call it the medical option. And so what this bill would do was on page, I guess it's delete 3, so it's basically removing the middle option, the medical option, and then it actually updates the information about the reporting options so that the original language had the I guess it was the one-time audit, and this would make it be an annual audit. Mm-hmm. And then it just changes the dates in the bill. The bill says 2017, and it updates those dates.
Okay, very good. Is there questions on amendment number 1? I guess the only question I would have is this. I think you have a zero fiscal note. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So would this change that? Or
no, it does not change it.
Okay. If there's no questions, then I will remove my objection to Amendment 1. Is there other objections? Okay. If not, then Amendment 1 will be adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there other amendments to Senate Bill or House Bill what are we, 31. Okay, thank you. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Senator Wilson.
I guess it's for the sponsor or the Department of Public Safety, just in looking at the number of reports we ask for on a continual basis from the different departments. I don't know if there's a time frame that we should look at reports or maybe a biannual number of sort of this reporting, because this reporting is, it seems to be that we can just ask for this report and get this on a regular basis. I don't know if the reporting needs to be in statute or is it just more of the public app response of it for the report. Just trying to.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Wilson, it's just to make it clear that we have that reporting requirement, so that it was one of the recommendations from across the country that it's very clear that there is this reporting requirement in states, and it's by November 1 of each year that the information should be collected and reported.
Go ahead, Senator Wilson.
Thank you.
Okay. Additional questions for the sponsor staff? Okay. Let's see. Did we take care of everything? I talked about the fiscal notes. There's zero. If the committee has no other questions, I think it's a good bill. So, Senator Diesel.
Mr. Chairman, I move the committee substitute for House Bill number 31, version 30LS0271/Omega, as amended from this committee to the next, with attached zero fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Okay, very good. Is there any objections? Seeing and hearing none, then if members could hang around and sign the individual recommendations, thank you very much. And also thank Representative Tarr for sneaking away from the House floor session there on dealing with the budget. She's probably happy to leave, actually. But okay, so that concludes our business for today. Thank you, committee members, for staying. Let's see. Well, I got some good news. I kept you over tonight, but next Thursday we are not going to meet, so we will not have a meeting next Thursday, March 29th. That's the day before Good Friday. And we do have another appointee to the Board of Fish, Duncan Fields, who will be here in person to testify on April 5th. So that'll be a little while. So our next meeting is March 27th, Tuesday, and we'll be taking up some more appointees. We have the Alaska Public Office Commission, APOC, and Helser is her name, Helser. And we also have the Police Standards Council appointees. And after that, then we'll take up House Bill 138, March Sobriety Awareness Month, and Senate Bill 210, Seafood Misrepresentation on Menus. Should be interesting. Okay, so if there's nothing else come for the committee, then we will stand adjourned. It is 5:23. We're adjourned.